I just really felt a challenge from the Lord to, Dan, walk the next 25 days behind your wife. Don't walk in front of her the next 25 days. And let her set the pace. To let someone else set your pace for 25 days, that was a gift in and of itself.
Welcome to Formation Conversations, a podcast of the Spiritual Formation Society of Arizona. We're having an ongoing conversation with friends about what it means to be formed into the image of Christ. Thank you for joining us. Well, hey, everybody. Welcome back to the podcast of the Spiritual Formation Society of Arizona. We are now releasing our second episode in this new kind of format that we have called Formation Conversations. Simple idea is that we're going to have a microphone and some friends talking about the spiritual life together, and with interesting people that are doing beautiful and wonderful things all over the country, all over the world, perhaps. And so it's been a great thing to be on this journey with my friend Ted Wiestey. My name is Gray Ewing. I'm a Presbyterian minister in the middle of central Phoenix, Arizona, at a church called Ascension Church of Phoenix. And I also help out at the Spiritual Formation Society of Arizona and love spending time with my good friend on air and in person at times, Ted Wiestey, who's also here with us.
Yeah, thanks, Gray. It is good to be together. And, you know, we often say if it's just us hanging out, getting to do a podcast, talking to some friends, that's worth it, even if no one else listens. But we are grateful for the listeners that we have, be they 14 or 1400. We're grateful. It's a joy to get to share. And I think so much of this life is about conversation and connecting. It's where so much transformation really happens. So I am excited to introduce a friend, Dan Huey, who I've gotten to know over the last handful of years, and excited just to have a conversation with him today. And Dan and his wife, Renee, live up in Seattle and just do some amazing, beautiful ministry up there. And so, Dan, welcome.
Thanks, Ted. It's good to be with you, to see you again, and to, just enjoy this time of friendship, and good to be with you too, Gray. And yeah, just looking forward to our conversation.
Yeah, well, thanks for joining us. One of the things that we're asking our guests to do as we do this sort of new format is bring something that you're, for the day, you know, the time of day is appropriate, something you're drinking or eating, a snack, whatever you want to do. We'll just talk about it for a second. And I'll start, okay? And okay. I have a cup of coffee, and we have an espresso machine, which I love. And this particular pod is peanut and roasted sesame, which has just become a favorite. And then I get a little bit of Trader Joe's oat milk creamer and put it in there. And it's like, oh, I love it.
Just so people are clear, you said Nespresso, right? With an N there. That's referring to the machine.
Yeah.
It's the bougier version of that. What is it? The other kind of pod?
Oh, like a Keurig?
Keurig. Yeah.
I noticed, yeah, Ted, when you said Nespresso, that there was a certain tone of enthusiasm, but when you said Keurig, it sort of drifted off.
That's right. And here we're talking to Dan, who lives in the coffee capital of the world.
That is right. And I was going to show up with my Nespresso this morning, but I forgot, and I brought water, for which my wife would be very proud of me. But I did bring water. I'm trying to turn over a new leaf and try to hydrate myself a little bit. And the other thing is, like, time-wise, I don't know, time of day. What I really wanted to bring is, there is a bakery within walking distance of us that has orange hazelnut pinwheels. And I really wanted to bring that thing, but I figured it would just be such a goopy mess and hard to eat while talking. And so instead, I brought my afternoon fascination, which is Trader Joe's Nuts About Rosemary mix. And these rosemary nuts are man, addictive, does not begin to speak to the level of dedication I have to these things.
Yeah. I've not tried
that. Jennifer bought a can of those. She bought a can of those the other day, and they are incredible. So good.
They are
rosemary kills it.
I'm going to have to try those, because for me, rosemary is the spice that takes over everything, right? I mean, if you have rosemary chicken or whatever, it's like, it's all rosemary, right? So I always, there's no such thing as little bit of rosemary. It's like, it's so powerful. But I do love the flavor. So I'm going to try that out.
Yeah.
I am taking Dan's water and upping it a few degrees and drinking Liquid Death. Which, if you don't know, is a sparkling water company. I mean, it looks like an energy drink, or maybe like a cross between an energy drink and a craft beer company. So it looks like I'm drinking something inappropriate here at work. But they have this kind of macabre death theme to it. So I am drinking Convicted Melon. instead of Convicted Felon, Convicted Melon. And it says on here to murder your thirst. So it was basically, it's good marketing. I mean, I grabbed it. I've had a few of these before. I've never had the Convicted Melon, but I'm enjoying it. And it's basically a very expensive way to drink sparkling water.
Wow. Okay. I've never had one of those, but you maybe convinced me to look at it next time I'm at the store.
Yeah. I mean, I'm just picturing the factory where it's made, you know, it's just like the normal factory and they just slap these labels on it. It's like nothing super death oriented about it, you know, but it's very good marketing and very good water. I think they have just like a regular water in a can too. It's like $4, you know, it's just water. It's like mountain water, but it's got some kind of like death name. And you're like, okay, wow. Just falling for it.
Why is death though a good marketing thing? I wouldn't think that'd be a good, just because you feel like you're on the edge, you know, with some edgy drink that might kill you?
I guess so. I mean, you know, that is a big theme in the energy drink world, which I don't really drink energy drinks. But if you look at energy drinks, it's all about kind of like destruction and stuff like that. And Monster, you know, and all these things. So maybe they're just trying to give people a healthier version of death. I don't know.
Okay. I drink life water. And
that's right.
Wow.
Hey, well, so Dan, you were talking about that bakery that's by your house. Have I been to that bakery? Is that the one that when I stayed with you that one time?
No, unfortunately, that is closed on the day that we're recording this. So sadly, this one is a few other blocks away. But yeah, now that bakery, They've got the goods. No, we are blessed to have a number of great places within walking distance. And, but the one across the street kills me, when they start baking their little cinnamon or chocolate babkas, which I'd never really heard of a babka before, but man, that thing is amazing. Yeah.
So you're in Seattle, your website is Soul Care Seattle, or that's your ministry. Maybe you could just situate that for in like 60 seconds or less, kind of tell us how you got there and what type of ministry you do in Seattle, this kind of for our listeners, you know, where you're coming from.
Yeah, perfect. So yeah, it's Soul Care Seattle at the Lane. It's sort of a two-pronged ministry. Soul Care Seattle is sort of what we do. And the Lane is, this house that we've basically been given in which to operate. And the people who gave us this house really saw it as wanting to develop a place in Seattle that would be a quiet refuge within the city. It's what we call an urban retreat house. And we host, in addition to spiritual direction and offering the spiritual exercises, we offer half-day retreats. We have a cottage where people can come for extended retreats, quiet days. Just a whole range of different things, listening prayer groups and so on and so forth. But it was really just intended to be a place of refuge and quiet that was accessible to those people who couldn't get outside of the city. Maybe they don't have cars. Maybe they don't have the other resources, time or money to spend 3 days out in the mountains, but they could come here.
Mm. I think maybe if someone's listening to this, they heard retreats, probably understand a little bit of what that means. But you also mentioned the exercises. What did you mean by the exercises, and like, what does that look like for you guys?
Yeah, great. So spiritual exercises of St. Ignatius. So this is the 9 month retreat that he envisioned 500 years ago. It's still in play today. And it's basically a prayer retreat where we meet weekly with individuals, and it just walks them through what St. Ignatius sort of imagined to be sort of the core principles that people needed in order to sort of realign their thinking with God and with themselves, to really come into a place of knowing and understanding, not in a head knowledge way that they're loved by God, but in a heart knowledge way. The knowledge of the love of God becomes something that we just absorb rather than what we strive for. And then it works out naturally in a return of love to God. So people pray on their own daily for an hour each day, and then they meet with us for spiritual direction once a week. And that's a 9 month, that's a 9 month journey. It's absolutely fabulous. It is through the exercises that my wife and I came to determine that we were to sell our business and our house and go into this ministry. So it's really sort of responsible for what we're doing today with our entire lives. So we love the exercises.
Well, tell me a little bit more about what you've seen develop in with Soul Care Seattle and your personal ministry of spiritual direction. I know you've been able to have a connection with those in the LGBTQ community. Can you say more about that?
Yeah, being situated in Seattle on Capitol Hill, you just really realize the wound between the LGBT community and the church, and this divide that seems to be impassable. And yet we believe wholeheartedly that spiritual direction offers a bridge for people who have been deeply wounded by the church, to be able to kind of explore. It's not like they've lost their questions about God or their love for God, but something has come in between them and God, and they need a place where they can enter into a zone of safety to explore those questions. And so we've just been very, very blessed to walk alongside of Christian or non-Christian LGBT or same-sex attracted individuals that want to further explore their conversation with the Lord. And it has just been a true gift. And to find out that many, many, many people in the LGBT community really long for a relationship with the Lord. And perhaps that has a lot to do with what the church might perceive as anger towards the church, is really just the frustration that most of them want a relationship with the Lord that they've been told that they can't have. And so just by entering into that wound and sitting with them and sort of working on image of God, image of self, just different pathways open up, and it's one of the deepest privileges we have. You know, it's not so different than walking with people who are just going through what we've now come to call a deconstruction of faith. We deal with a lot of that. But we also deal with a lot of pastors. It's really surprising. We deal with a lot of pastors that are really coming to realize for the first time, maybe they've been in the pulpit for maybe 20 years, but they're just now starting to come to realize that maybe God actually does love them and love their people. It's amazing. But again, it's this practice of spiritual direction and contemplative practices that provide that safety for people to explore these things in ways that they've never been able to express them before in traditional settings.
I think a lot of people that we talk to are noticing that there's kind of an awakening or a hunger for this in different parts of the country. Certainly that's been so here. And we just talked to someone last conversation in Arkansas, of all places, the same kind of thing. What are you noticing about Seattle and just the hungers that are there, the circles that you're running in that you're seeing? Like, where is the spiritual desire? What does that look like for the people that you interact with?
And it's an interesting question, because I can try to answer it through the lens of my typical church going lens that says, like, our hunger looks, you know, obvious in these certain ways, right? Like, that people are just really itching to know God, and they're wanting to read scripture and understand it and things like that. But I actually see the hunger working out in people's desire to connect with one another, and the level of frustration that we have in our connections with other people. It's like this misplaced hunger that just keeps working out in ways that look very detrimental on the outside. Like, it looks like society is actually sort of pulling apart, but I actually sort of feel like what I see is it's actually just a desperate love for longing for connection. And so it's actually kind of beautiful. I know that sounds weird to say, but a lot of the things that I think that traditionally I might've looked at as being disturbing or disquieting, is actually just, an outworking of something that is really a beautiful longing. And so I think to see that place in us that is designed for God, and that is the part of us that images God. And it's just desperate. It's like looking for water, looking for air. That might sound a little bit too ethereal, but I feel like it's helpful to look at things in that way, because it helps me see the beauty and what's going on around us in ways that maybe we have found to be a little bit offensive or unnerving. Did that answer your question at all?
It's very good. I do. I mean, it's a paradox, right? But it's so is many things in the scriptures, the dying to live, you know, the first will be last, and on it goes. And what I hear you saying is that you're living in some of those paradoxes, some destruction that seems negative at first, but it's there's some life being reformed there. There's some resurrection power.
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the key points from St. Ignatius is to really ask the Holy Spirit to unearth and expose to you your deepest longings. And it's important, because those longings will press us into various places. But for the most part, we've been taught to maybe that our longings should be seconded to something else, or limited, or that we are to live a life of sacrifice and service. And that's not wrong, but it does sort of set up this dynamic that maybe what's going on inside of me is unwelcome before the Lord. It's unwelcome before the church. And yet, if we actually sort of understood those longings, we might actually be a little bit more moving toward loving one another. And it allows us to be a non-anxious presence to the people that God's put in our midst. And that's, whoa, what a gift.
Yeah, it seems like if God is truly in the midst of and at work in all things, then whatever is, whatever is in front of me is a space where God's at work and with a person whom God loves deeply.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And again, this isn't just, you know, I know that we started this out talking about our ministry to the LGBT community, which is near and dear to my heart for a myriad of reasons. But I think that this is really all of us that we're talking about here. It's not just those things that we see around us that cause us anxiety. It could be how I cause anxiety to other people. It could be how I'm, you know, sort of acting out maybe in more hidden ways, perhaps even more spiritual ways, that are unhelpful or unloving to the people around me, just because I'm out of touch with what it is that I'm longing for. And if I'm out of touch for what I'm longing for, how can I possibly let God meet me there? And so I'm just going to be scrappy and acting out in all sorts of ways, controlling my kids. There's some low hanging fruit.
Could you say something more about that, about acting out in, I think you said, in spiritual ways?
Yeah, I think we all act out in spiritual ways. It's interesting. A quote has been sort of hanging over my head lately, and I've got it here somewhere. Well, maybe I don't. But it's from Henry Nouwen, and he says, I'll just read this one sentence. It's from his book, The Inner Voice of Love. It says, "A split between divinity and humanity has taken place in you. With your divinely endowed center, you know God's will, God's way, and God's love. But your humanity is cut off from that. Your many human needs for affection, attention, and consolation are living apart from your divine sacred space. Your call is to let these two parts of yourself come together again." And I love that idea of the split between our humanity and divinity, these two spaces within us. And, you know, to let these two things come back together, the more I've thought about it, all I can do is rest and let God draw these two things together. And so it's easy to sort of forget that sacred space in us. It's easy to sort of forget our soul and how our soul relates to God, and to just sort of relate to God out of our humanity. And to just sort of like, okay, I'm going to do more. I'm going to be more. I'm going to be better. I'm going to perfect. This is a great one. This is one I really struggle with. I am going to perfect the contemplative life. You know, I just don't think that we can perfect the contemplative life, right? That leads to its own pile of muck. And so this idea of, you know, acting out spiritually is this place where we want to take control, where we're somehow at a place of unease or dis-ease within ourselves. And can we just sort of serve that up on a platter before the Lord? I use Rublev's Trinity quite a bit, and I sort of see myself offering this pile of muck within myself and just sort of putting it up on the altar and watching the Holy Three interact with whatever it is that's going inside of me that I can't name. Or I can do what comes naturally to me and try to sort of pray my way out of things, or work my way out of things, or study my way out of things, or maybe whiskey my way out of things. Just depends on the day.
Well, it seems like the dynamic of control is really at play in all of that. And you mentioned controlling your kids, as I hear you say all that, I think, am I in control of my spiritual life in a way that I manage it and manipulate it and develop it? Or is the Lord the one who is keeping that life? And my invitation is to simply offer the muck up to that space and say, okay, Lord, I don't know. Got it.
Yeah.
The more I think about these things and experience growth in these areas, I think that is kind of the watershed issue. Mm. I mean, so many of us, you know, people talk about what is spiritual direction? What is spiritual formation? It's these intangible things. And I almost think that is one of the clearest ways to talk about it, is say it's moving from a less directive, you know, this is what I'm going to do, to a more receptive or, you know, kind of posture of this is what's happening to me, or it's an awareness or that kind of thing. And there are vestiges of that, I think, in all of us, even when we start, as you mentioned, down the spiritual formation path, those vestiges start popping up. I mean, even last year when I was going through some, severe anxiety that I had never experienced before. This is totally foreign to my experience. I've lived a lot of my life with a lot of sense of control and moving from one thing to the next, and very type A and, you know, very performance driven. And then my body started doing things that I had no control of. And to then just be sitting in that place. And actually I reread, the Nouwen's book that you quoted just then. And I remember actually weeping at that passage on the back porch reading it, because it's just, what do you do when you can't do anything? You know, like literally if I started going down the path of, well, this is how I'll get better, it's if I do this and then I do this, and then my mind started doing that whole anxious kind of circuit. And it just literally, I cannot do anything. You know, it's the moment that I start down that path, it starts, the problem starts over again. And there's almost a gift of saying, the only thing I can do is be aware of this, offer it up. And then it's amazing because God does heal it, right? He does, he does things in you, but it's not because of what you're doing. It's because of what you're offering up to him, letting him do, you know? And, I almost feel like that is almost a boundary line between, when we're on the spiritual walk, we hit a wall when we realize we can't, there's a point beyond which we can control any of this.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That is really beautiful, Greg. And I, what you're saying reminds me of two things. It reminds me of, you know, you look at the Old Testament scriptures that talk about being a tree planted by streams of water. And, you know, the tree doesn't control its growth. Its growth is passive to the tree, right? The tree's just being a tree. And the hard part is, I think, for us, or at least for me, to let myself be human, to let myself just simply be an incarnated spirit that really can't control the world around me, that is the object of God's delight, just as I am. And I think that leads me to the second point of what was coming in as you were talking, Gray, is, I like to muse with just exactly what did Jesus mean when he said it is finished? Like, how far out does that go into our world? What are the implications of that? It is finished. And does that mean that we can rest? And what does that rest look like?
Wow. Yeah. I think we could pause with that for a while. Mm-hmm. You know, there's something obviously incredibly attractive about rest. Mm-hmm. And yet it's also very threatening to our false sense of self, because rest, even as our hearts long for that, really is about releasing, acknowledging the reality that I'm not in control.
But even Ted, as I sit with what you were just saying there, I mean, it's so interesting to me, right? Like that rest is so vulnerable, so intimate, so sacred, so trusting. It's almost too much. Well, no, it is too much to hope for. Like it is. I think that is why we run from it, right? It's just too, it's too beautiful. It's too intimate that our Creator would say, welcome into my rest, or it is finished. That fearful place of giving up our striving, but it is deeply alluring as well. I'm not sure how far I want to take this, but I think that there's something exceptionally, I don't know. Okay. So I'll just say it. To me, it seems that it seems almost like there is a sexual component to that. Like there's this place of deep vulnerability and deep longing and deep safety and deep intimacy. That is beyond sort of what we can imagine. That is very unitive. It's very securing, very safe, very, very one, very right. I don't know. I'm just musing. Mm-hmm.
I don't think that goes too far, because certainly the Lord uses that metaphor of sexual union, in the Song of Songs. Husband and wife, the scriptures. So there's a part of me that thinks, man, we could just kind of, let's close the podcast here and place some rest. Mm-hmm. Wow. These are so good. Such good things to think about and, sit with. And, certainly listeners, I encourage you, pause the podcast right here and sit with this for as long as you'd like. And also, Dan, we want to ask you a little bit about pilgrimage. It's a bit of a theme for us with the Spirit Formation Society of Arizona this year. It's a theme of our conference. We've created a 9-mile pilgrimage within the heart of Phoenix that we're inviting people.
Love it.
But you and Renee have done long pilgrimages over the last couple of years. And the one that I first remember you guys doing, maybe there's others as well, but in Spain a couple of years ago, you walked a pilgrimage that was, people are often very familiar with the Camino de Santiago, right? Mm-hmm, the pilgrim up in Santiago. But you guys did an Ignatian journey. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. Wow. What a trip. And I don't just mean like the vacation sort of trip. I mean, it just was so mind blowing. It truly was an amazing gift to be able to go on this thing. So what we did, it was, so we did our spiritual formation training through Sila West. And then Renee and I went on to get our formation in Ignatian spiritual direction. And when we were doing that, someone pointed out that it was the 500th anniversary of the spiritual exercises. And so Renee and I just got this BNR bonnet that we were to do this pilgrimage that goes from St. Ignatius's birthplace in Loyola, Spain, to Manresa, Spain, where he wrote the spiritual exercises. And that turns out to be a 27-day journey, roughly 400 miles, through 5 different regions of Spain, mountains, deserts, vineyards, hotels, pensions, casa rurales, as they would call them, cities with water, and one city that didn't have water. It was a tremendous experience. And we really traveled by ourselves pretty much the entire time. In fact, you know, usually like there's a starting point for these pilgrimages and you find yourself seeing other people that are starting out on the journey at roughly the same day. You can kind of figure out who's going to be doing this and who's not, whether you don't know these individuals, but you see their backpacks and you sort of get an eye for it. We didn't see anybody. And we thought that we were the only people making this journey, that we're going to be on the same day on the same calendar as we were. But 5 or 6 days in, we ran into these two young women from Poland and they were also making the journey. But other than that, we were on our own for 27 days and, amazing. So I could talk for days about it. And I think it does tie into what we were just talking about, this idea of letting go of control, but also the invitation to rest, the invitation to, to just be with the Lord in a way that is so completely outside of your comfort zone, where you don't have your little tools that you can easily fall back on, and to, to just let go of control and just take another step, baby. You've got a lot more to go, so got to keep moving.
I went when I was in seminary for 3 weeks to Israel, and archaeological study trip. So it was kind of more of a class than anything. But we went to these sites, and when I got back, I actually presented. I was an intern at a church at the time, and I taught a class on, like, did I just go on a pilgrimage? You know, and. Which is a tricky thing to do in our context, right? The Reformed, you know, tradition that I'm a part of doesn't always look so kindly on some of those things that seem a little bit more Roman, you know, to, right. to the outside eye. But it, when I got down to it, it was a little bit hard to describe, right? What was happening. I'd love to hear from you, given all the context of what we just said, which is that we don't direct these things, right? And also given that there's a lot of mystery around, you know, these concepts, but, you know, I mean, as people that are looking for direction, for instance, you know, we were just reading Henry Nouwen, and he helps people have a spiritual life, right? Even if he's not directing them exactly what's happening, what kind of boundaries would you put around this idea of pilgrimage? You'd say, like, what's happening? Like, what's the goal? Like, if someone were interested in doing it, what should they expect? You know, just a little bit of the framework of what pilgrimage is, you know, according to you, you know, in your experience. I'm not saying you're the authority of all time or something, but what is the goal? What is the hope, I guess, maybe?
You know, I, having been on a couple of these things now, and then we're going to do another one this coming spring of 2025, we're going to do the Portuguese route, the coastal route up to Santiago, Spain, with another group. And I think it's fair to come in with your own expectations of what should happen, that there should be this transformative moment as you visit maybe these holy sites, or as you discard your phone for a number of weeks or whatever it's going to be, that there would be some level of transformation that we're longing for. Right. And it would be easy to kind of say that maybe this is what one can expect. But the best advice was given to me by another spiritual director, which is that everybody has their own Camino. Everybody has their own way. Essentially everybody has their own pilgrimage. And so you really cannot predict what someone is going to experience or what the fruit of it will be. I think the safe expectation is that you will be stripped of many things that you did not realize that you were relying on, and you will be opened to new insights without those things, and let those insights provoke new questions within you. I think that's sort of the exciting part, is to realize that it's great to have your expectations and bring those hopes. And it's by bringing those hopes and letting some of those things get challenged, that maybe deeper hopes are revealed in you. Okay, it's not going to be about this. It's going to be about that. Mm-hmm. And it's just something that you can't predict. But there is something, you know, we talk a lot here at the Lane Soul Care Seattle, our ministry. We talk a lot about stillness, solitude, and silence. And, you know, there's something about getting away, quieting yourself. And people have different ways of doing their pilgrimages. We encourage people to spend most of the day in silence. I know that it seems weird because you're walking, but there is a stillness to it. There's an unhurried pace to it. a funny thing is that like when we were on the Ignatian Camino from Loyola to Manresa, Spain, my wife, I just so wanted to walk ahead and I wanted to make sure that I would get to the next town and be able to find our lodging and be able to find food and rest my feet and all this sort of stuff. And I really struggled with like just how it would expose my anger and frustration and my tension of wanting my wife to walk faster with me. And I had to pray about that for a couple of days because I realized like, okay, we're going to be walking for almost a month. This is going to end very badly if I don't figure out what to do with this thing that's going on inside of me. I just really felt a challenge from the Lord to, Dan, walk the next 25 days behind your wife. Don't walk in front of her for the next 25 days and let her set the pace. And just, I mean, even that was revealing enough to let someone else set your pace for 25 days. That was a gift in and of itself.
And much more someone that you're intimately acquainted with, right?
Right.
Right. Like, yeah.
I mean, that was rough, but it was also beautiful. It was so good to just let her set the pace. And for me to just realize like, you know, spend the next 25 days just exploring all the different ways that I've been running ahead of her. You know, it just really opened up to a deeper awareness in our relationship that, you know, I thought I was going to have this big moment. So St. Ignatius has this moment in his life before he writes the exercises where he goes to Montserrat, which is this huge, beautiful monastery. And if you haven't seen it before, I would really encourage you to look it up. But Montserrat is just way up in the mountains in these rock formations. And they've built this beautiful monastery up there where 500 years ago, he laid down his sword. He gave up his sort of earthly notions of who he was to be as a lesser nobleman and military guy. He lays down his sword before the statue of the Madonna there. And I really entered into that pilgrimage thinking like, what is my sword that I'm going to lay down? You know, what is it that I have to offer the Lord here? And then go on to Manresa, which is the next day of the pilgrimage, to where he wrote the exercises. What am I going to be called to write? So there was this desire to have this moment of letting go and then this moment of receiving. And the funny thing was, is that I didn't have a moment of letting go or receiving. It was, you know, 25, 27 days of letting go and receiving a new way of being. So you don't know how or when something will hit you. But that was a very meaningful experience for me to just dedicate those days to the Lord.
You know, as I hear you share all that, Dan, and I think often people would say, well, why do a pilgrimage of any kind? Why do this embodied sort of walk, whether it's, you know, 27 days or 2 weeks or a day or whatever it is? And what's striking me with what you're saying is, in many ways, you're intentionally putting yourself in a place where you're not in control.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, and even, you know, with this pilgrimage that you'll do with the society there in Arizona, there is this place of where, you know, just by consenting to it, you've already said yes to changing your way of life for that time. You are putting one step in front of another. And you'll always be faced with a choice of like, well, do I go back or do I continue on? How does this end? Where am I going? Right. And so there's just this repetitive question that keeps coming up. Right. And so say if you get injured or something like that, well, then okay, well, now what do I do? Do I take an Uber? Do I do this? Do I do that? How do I get back to where I began? And can we let go of our desire then to say that I walk the 9 miles if I'm going to finish in an Uber or in a bus? Can I say yes to this thing turning out completely differently than I thought it was going to? Every moment is a different decision. So for instance, when we were on, I think it was day 11, which was probably, you know, close to like 150 miles into our 400 plus mile journey, Renee got a soft tissue injury in her foot. So on top of the blisters and on top of backpacks and all this sort of stuff, she got a soft tissue injury. And, you know, we were left with this decision. How are we going to finish? You know, we've come halfway around the world. Are we going to, you know, fly to Barcelona and just call it a day? Are we going to hop on a train or a bus? And each day she had to wake up and, you know, just evaluate with the Lord, you know, do I walk today? Do I take a cab? What do I do? For her, you know, the Lord said to continue walking. And so she walked, and she was able to complete it. But that was really another challenge to me, was like, oh, what is this going to do to me and my expectations of how life is going to be if my wife is injured and needs to, it sounds terrible, but I was like, yeah, come on, honey, you can do this. You know, it was a real challenge for me to let go of things that weren't even under my control. Like I couldn't, yeah. There's just so much. And I think it's important to this idea of getting our bodies engaged is a big piece of this. Again, it's that sort of split between the human side of us, or the body, the flesh, and the divine. And there's something about, we can give assent to letting go of control, but we need to get our bodies engaged in that. We need to get our bodies in a place where they don't have control, and to remind our bodies that they're not in control. Because we can think we've given up control, but until you put your body out there, you really are telling yourself really nice stories.
Well, I appreciate what you said earlier about everyone has their own pilgrimage. Yeah. And some of the meditation would certainly be about paying attention to the pilgrimage that you're on, the pilgrimage that God is shaping for you, not what someone else is doing or even what you thought you would do.
Yes. Which isn't that life, right? I think one of the biggest gifts of this, of embracing pilgrimage, well, it's been a tremendous gift to our ministry, as spiritual directors and retreat leaders and, you know, group leaders, you know, all the lead. We can so easily forget that everybody's on their journey, that everybody's on their same path, right? And I think, oh gosh, if we go all the way back to the beginning of this, where we were talking about spiritual direction being sort of a bridge between disaffected people in the church. It's like, so often we have wanted to see people as having a set path as opposed to their own paths. So often, if I want to make this a little bit more true to myself, I might have had ideas of my children's path, but lo and behold, they have their own path. And when I came to the realization of that and began to get myself body, mind, and spirit behind their own path, it did wonders for our relationship. And I have an easier time being a non-anxious presence and non-anxious father to my adult kids. By just letting them have their own Camino, letting them have their own pilgrimage of life. And being curious about that, like not curious in sort of a invasive way, but like a holy curiosity of like, what is God's spirit like in you? And And what helps that thrive? What have you found that helps your spirit thrive within you?
Well, Dan, thank you. I feel like we could keep talking for another couple of hours.
I would like that.
Yeah. And I look forward to when you're in Arizona next, or I'm up there next and we can have a little more time. But thank you just for the conversation today and hearing what you're up to. Talk a little bit about pilgrimage. You're really grateful.
Yeah, thank you, Dan. It's been very rich. Ted, I wondered if you might want to say a bit more too about the pilgrimage here in Phoenix before we close out for today. Is there an invitation there that we can extend?
Yeah. So our annual conference this year is February 6th and 7th, and it's on the theme of pilgrimage. And we'll go a lot of different directions with that. And then the day after, on Saturday, February 8th, we're inviting people to walk this 9-mile path that we've curated really over the last year. Mm-hmm. And it starts in Central Phoenix on the Bridle Path, goes up to the canal, goes along the canal for probably 3.5 miles, and then actually into the Phoenix Mountains Preserve, all the way to 40th Street, where it then ends at the prayer garden at Canaan in the desert. So we're just inviting people to walk it with us as they feel led. And I think we're actually in the spirit of like the Camino de Santiago. There's going to be a little stamp that people get at the end as they complete it. We're going to offer some thoughts on pilgrimage and how someone might engage it, all the while acknowledging that everybody has their own way of making the pilgrimage. And we have a website for it where we'll be uploading, you know, maps and updates and all these kind of things. And it's CaminoDePhoenix.com. So let's check that out.
I love it. What a brilliant idea. Yeah, absolutely brilliant. You guys, this has been tremendous. Thank you so much for the invitation and for spending the time. And Greg, good to meet you. And Ted, really great to see you again, my friend. And yeah, thank you.
It's been a blessing. And if you're in the Seattle area and you're listening to this, or I don't know, do you guys do probably Zoom stuff as well? I don't know.
Yeah, we're online and in person. Yeah.
So no matter where you are, soulcareseattle.com be a great place to check out if you're interested in more of Dan and his wife's work and the others that are involved with that. And you can go to sfsaz.org, which is the Spiritual Formation Society of Arizona's website as well. If you're looking for a spiritual director, you're looking to sign up for that conference that was just talked about, you'd like to be part of that pilgrimage, we'd love to have you be part of that, or part of a soul care day or a silent retreat or any number of things that are on offer at the Spiritual Formation Society.
Well, as they say on the pilgrimage route, buen camino.
I don't know what the response is. Yeah. And also, and also with you.
And also with you.
Amen. Yep. Amen. Oh, thanks everybody. It's been great to be together.
Blessings, you guys.
Until next time.
See you then.
Bye-bye.